Hi, everybody. This is Dean Haglund from the Office of Irrational Exuberance here in the heart of the historic core of downtown Los Angeles in the middle of the Eastern Columbia building, which is the Art Deco Wonder. Hooray! This is your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, and I am here, as always, with the faithful co-host, Mr. Nuffity Nuff, Ocho Cinco, Phil Ernest.
You don't want to see the profile picture that I have on Facebook?
Yeah. Should we look at everybody go to... Oh, look at that.
I kind of blend into a Rousseau.
Look at you.
Isn't that interesting?
You always blend into a Rousseau in my books.
Hey, happy holidays, everybody.
Oh, yes. This is the beginning of the holiday season.
It really is. It's upon us like a fever.
A freight train that I forgot to wrap. Really.
And, of course, it's... because it's the holidays, it's damn near 90 degrees here in Los Angeles.
Yes, we pity the rest of the planet.
People don't appreciate this, but, you know, I've lived in L.A. now a long time, and there was one year when at Christmas time we actually did get snow.
Yes.
In Los Angeles.
77?
No, I mean since I've lived here since 85. one year, about 20 years ago, we had snow. But most of the time, most every year, it is 90 degrees on Christmas Day and beautifully sunny.
Beautiful sunny.
But, you know, you have a lot to do. I have a lot to do.
It's crazy.
I'm apt to get up in the morning, get right to work.
Yep.
I just turn on the heater and seriously, and then I get to work, right?
What do you
and
turn
this
on the
weekend,
heater for?
When I finally left, because, you know, my place, it stays nice and cool,
yeah,
even in summertime. It never, without air conditioning, it never gets up above 75 degrees. And... so here's the thing, is it's nice and cool. I have the heater on. I get dressed thinking it's middle December. I leave to go to a party at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'm sweating buckets.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we actually...
I smell barbecues. I'm not kidding.
I would barbecue. We had the air conditioning on as we were doing our Christmas baking. Is that wrong? It's supposed to be that the hearth warms the cockles of the... family heart to that as you cook the pie. Oh, we're having pie later, by the way.
Oh.
Yes. Wait till you taste that. it's crazy. Meanwhile, the rest of the country,
you know, people love
fall and snow.
People love the TV series The Top Chef, the reality competition show Top Chef, which is kind of like the Project Runway for food, right?
Sure.
I never a Top Chef fan, and it's more popular, I think, than the Project Runway,
mm-hmm,
because everybody loves food.
Right. You get cooking ideas.
But I'm not a Top Chef fan because, as we've talked about with the mentoring on Project Runway and everything, you can have your own vested interest in the criticism that's being levied against the designer, for example. Whereas in Top Chef, we can't taste it.
Yeah, but you can imagine a delicious pomegranate.
But then they say, oh, well, no, this is a little, needs a little more salt, or it needs a little more this, or it needs a little more. And it's like that whole process is not really, I don't understand why that's interesting, because I can't have a vested interest beyond how it looks. And as we know, two dishes, one can look much better than another one.
Yes.
But, and this is the whole idea behind food styling, which is a real job in the entertainment industry, right?
Yeah.
A food stylist.
I pulled out of the fridge here. These are persimmon date ginger squares.
Well.
Yes. And with a lemon frosting topping with lemon zest. Now, I would have not thought to put persimmons and dates together if I didn't watch Top Chef. Now you're having a bite. What do you think? It's been in the fridge. It's not fresh out of the oven. It's exactly 8 hours old.
The first the first bite was a little too citrusy for my taste, but then I love, the more you get into the flavors, the more bite there is.
Yeah. Well, I added extra lemons in the actual frosting, so... anyway, we'll be eating that during the show.
Well, that's lovely.
This show brought to you by Persimmon Date Squares.
No, this show is brought to you. Yeah. This is your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. And this show, as every episode we've ever done, which you can find all 186 before today's show.
Holy.
At chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com. And all 186 episodes prior to today and today's, brought to you by Chill Pack.
Right.
And the reason that I front-load that announcement at the beginning of this is that it is the holiday season. People are looking for gifts. I know I plug this each and every week. I have given in the past, many, many people, all of them delighted and satisfied by the gift, Chilpacks.
Mm-hmm.
And it is cool to give a gift that actually, you know, is useful.
For your laptop.
And everybody has a laptop computer. And whether they know it or not, heat is affecting the performance of that laptop, if not the longevity.
Absolutely.
It. And,
you know what I found out now with Hulu? Everybody brings their laptop to bed to watch TV if you don't have a TV in your mm-hmm. and they put it on a pillow. And that pillow will act as a blanket over it and will burn out your computer in half the time as if you left it just on a desk. So bring the Chilpack to bed with you.
I have done that in the past.
Have you?
Yeah.
And it works great, right? Because that fan is actually rather annoying if you're falling asleep and trying to watch a...
Now, let me ask you one thing about this before we leave, because this is a big gift. But I'm fascinated by this, that right now it's $19.95 for the holidays, a Chilpack with free shipping anywhere in the world.
Anywhere in the world.
And that means... Really, if it's outside the U.S., mm-hmm. from where all the shipping comes,
yep.
if it's outside the U.S., and maybe we're not supposed to talk about the business side of this here, but there's literally no profit. And so this is the thing that I think is really cool, is that, you know, not only is it a great deal, but for the holidays, I mean, you're letting people have a great gift that, you know, around the world, and you're cutting out basically any idea of profit.
Well, I want to be generous this holiday season.
And I think that's cool, because things are tough all over.
That's right. And your laptop will be the thing that will be the most expensive to replace. So if you can save that by keeping it cool, then you can sort of ride out this recession, crash, depression, financial situation that we find ourselves globally in.
Yes.
I don't know what you're going
Nicely
to call it.
Done.
Yes, exactly.
Now, you are about to leave on a holiday road trip.
Epic, epic road trip, where I will be driving to Canada and then coming back through the U.S.
Wow.
A big loop.
With your dogs.
With the dogs. A big SUV that I'm renting in California that has no snow tires. I'm not sure if it has antifreeze, and it has no engine block heater. Which
now, where are you renting this?
I'm renting it here, right in Los Angeles, from Hertz Rent a Car. I can say them; okay. They're lovely. I'm a Gold Plus member.
And they're fantastic. And they let you go into other states. I mean, one of the things that's so frustrating about renting in California is many of the rental car companies don't let you take it out of state.
Yeah, you can't even drive to Vegas, for crying out loud. But this one it lets you drive around internationally, and is just
internationally.
International.
Well, I guess you're right. Yeah, Canada.
Canada's another nation.
We're going to talk about Canada a lot in this show, actually.
I
have some things that I want to... We kind of had them on the agenda last week, and I want to
I'm all about... talk about them. I got Canada all down, my friend.
I know you do.
I can answer a lot of questions about that kind of...
You are very Canadian, even though... are you now an American citizen?
I'm still waiting for my paperwork to say come to the swearing-in oath-taking ceremony. I have yet to do that, but other than that, I have answered all my questions correctly. I have stated that I've not been to jail and that I like living here.
Now, I want to follow up on a couple things that we talked about, some issues we brought up last week, news and other things. But first, a correction. We were talking about the show that David Duchovny did in New York, Break of Noon, the new Neil LaBute at the MCC.
Right.
And I said that Sam Gold, a really famous New York director who's... just tomorrow starting to direct
Lily.
A South Coast rep production of his play that he directed in New York, Circle Mirror Transformation, that he's taking over as artistic director of MCC, and that was majorly incorrect. He's taking over the Roundabout, which is actually a much bigger deal.
That's a much bigger deal.
Much bigger deal. Yeah. The Roundabout. And why it's important that I mention that is because...
He's a fan of the show.
Well, his effort to slash prices across the board to make theater much more accessible is also a much bigger deal when you consider it's at the Roundabout.
Yes.
I mean, the Roundabout has, what, three theaters, usually has three productions going, has the American Airlines theater in New York.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So this is a big, big deal.
Big deal. Roundabout's a very...
anyway, so I got that mistaken. So.
Well, and I'm glad he's slashing prices because I went and saw Helen Hunt in Much Ado About Nothing.
You
at the
didn't.
I did.
When did you go?
I went on Saturday, saw the matinee.
This is so funny because I ran into, at a birthday party, my old friend Joshua Reeve Randall, who starred on the TV series Ed.
Of course.
And a short-lived series, Courting Alex. He's now on The Event. Handsome actor. We know him as The Bruise. That's what we always call him. I gave him his first acting role ever back in my first film. He was a grip in the film, fresh out of film school. And I said, who is this kid? He's the hardest working crew member. And they go, well, that's Josh. He goes to school. He wants to be an actor. And I go, he wants to be an actor. And so at the end of this 24-day shoot, you know, this guy was so hardworking and always upbeat and always, just great guy. I called him over one day and I said, you want to act in this film? Because there was this one part that we hadn't cast.
You forgot to cast.
And just hadn't. And I thought, you know, at some point I'll make a decision because, you know, you have so many auditions. And it's just a role with a couple lines. You figure you'll see. And then I just said, let's see what this guy can do. And he was great.
Wow.
Great. But anyway, I run into him and he has to leave early because he's going to see Helen Hunt, but not just Helen Hunt at the Kirk Douglas.
No.
Which is why you had to go because you were there basically. Did they ask you to come to be the Kirk Douglas lookalike?
That's right.
Look, Kirk Douglas is here.
Hi, welcome to my theater.
But
I said, no, I don't.
You know, when you think of the immortal bard of Stratford-upon-Avon, you think about Much Ado About Nothing. Obviously, you don't just think of Helen Hunt. You also think of Lyle Lovett.
Lyle Lovett, of all things. Putting a country music twang, performing live with a little acoustic surrounding him. Had a couple lines. He was Balthazar, of course. So he had a...
So how was it?
It was pretty good. It abridged a couple of the scenes, of course, you know.
Now, on a scale of 1 to 10... with 10 being a massive change, how much are you going to change your opinion once we're off air?
Zero. Yeah, because I thought, you know, there was parts of it. Okay, first, you got to like country music because they situation the whole thing.
As with any Shakespeare play, so important to like country music.
No, that's the thing. You don't have to like country music. That's my point. They've set it in a country, a winery. California winery with country music as its background.
I see.
And the whole thing sponsored by Gallo. So it looked like they were actually popping real bottles of Ernest Gallo's Reds up on stage. I don't know. Some of the acting, they weren't all on the same caliber, but what are you going to do?
Well, I make fun of the idea of Helen Hunt and...
She's an Oscar winner.
And Lyle Lovett. Well, and this play... is, I kid you not, you need a chill pack.
Oh, I do too.
Yeah, it's making a lot of noise, that laptop.
I brought it
down. Helen Hunt, the Much Ado About Nothing, this play that you went to see, is the answer to a question that I actually had asked the week before. I was going, whatever happened to Helen Hunt?
No.
How do you go from hit show and Oscar to virtually nothing overnight?
Well, I think she took some time off.
The last one was, you know, What Women Want was like the last hit movie she had.
That's right. And then Mel Gibson.
And,
right?
And that was more than a decade ago.
Wow. When did she win her Oscar? What year was that?
98.
Wasn't that 2002?
No, I don't
think
so. Anyway, as much as I'm fun, as much as I tease Helen Hunt and Lyle Lovett doing Shakespeare, on the other hand, you wouldn't necessarily think Denzel Washington and Keanu Reeves when thinking Much Ado About Nothing. Yeah. And yet they were two of the stars
in the movie
film
version.
And it was a great film version.
It was a pretty good. Yeah, I liked it.
Of course, when you have Emma Thompson and Kenneth Branagh in charge, that
you
helps.
Got big money.
That yeah, helps yeah. A little
they,
bit.
They little they got the
they
chin.
Know a thing or two
but Helen
about
Hunt,
a thing or two.
Yes. Helen Hunt though looks great. She hasn't changed at all, practically.
I thought you said she looks great.
Oh,
damn. Hit her again. She's still moving.
Call the burn unit. Holy smokes. What a snap out of the air.
I don't know.
Whatever.
I'm using up my... Every year at the beginning of the year, I get a shipment of material, and I'm using up. I'm dragging the bottom at this point.
This is what the comedy writer sent you that you forgot to use all year?
Yeah. Now... are we done with Much Ado About Nothing?
It was fantastic. I will show you the autograph program I got.
We were talking a bit about you know, the how we live in a time right now where there are certain on television, on screen, let's say, there is some great acting.
Yep.
I mean, just groundbreaking acting, like Javier Bardem and Beautiful, we were mentioning. How about, you know, even on the small screen, our friend Vince Gilligan, his show Breaking Bad, I mean, the work that Bryan Cranston does.
Holy.
The whole cast.
Yeah.
Still, I mean, Bryan Cranston carrying that show, and it's really, in terms of acting on television, I mean, it's just...
epic.
Incredible. And then at the same time, I mean, that gave me the impression, from the television I watched,
uh-huh.
I was thinking, wow, this is a golden age of acting on television.
Uh-huh.
And then I start flipping around to some of these other shows, like Chase, like Castle, like Law & Order Los Angeles. You know, I haven't watched a Law & Order series in 20 years. I'm thinking...
Law & Order UK on BBC America... Watch that.
Well, but the point that I'm making, though, is I started going outside of my comfort zone, out of the shows that I would watch, to see the wider range, because I'm thinking, wow, I mean, if this is indicative of the quality that's going on, this is incredible. And then I turn in all these shows, and the reason I brought up Law & Order is Los Angeles, is that it kind of suffers from the same sort of jokey sensibility in its acting that I mentioned with all these other shows. And... Two thoughts occurred to me. One was, of course, well, actually three things. And but one was that, of course, I think you need
some levity.
The other, well, not the levity. You need levity, but jokey. The jokey sensibility is not
levity
at all. No. That is dark because it is so dehumanizing and right. so desensitizing. I got into a discussion about the show Psych afterwards, yeah. right? And one of the points that was brought up was, you know, hey, it's not a bad show if at the end of a hard day it makes me smile.
Right.
Well, that depends. I mean, why at the end of a hard day...
Yeah, but okay, so to be fair, though, you...
But I get this all the time. I get this all the time, that the idea of entertainment is, hey, it's just to entertain us. It's just to, hey, at the end of another shitty day of work, it makes it possible for me to smile and then go on again. Well, maybe what would be better is a show that inspires you to get out of that shitty fucking job. Maybe that would be better. But the point that I wanted to make about this jokey sensibility is, you know, there was a New Yorker article about Men in Black and Tommy Lee Jones when that first came out.
Right.
And it was about acting.
Okay.
And, you know, they said that, you know, mark our words, that this is going to be kind of a turning point. Because Tommy Lee Jones in this movie does something that already in blockbusters we're seeing actors not do, which is he's taking it seriously. He's playing it straight.
Right.
We're running out of actors who have the integrity
to be committed.
To be committed.
Right.
And the good news, though, because as you know, I think there's always some way in which it's serving us. So it's not about levity, because there's plenty of shows that offer levity. Yeah. And I'll get a show that you were on for many years offered levity amidst the darkness.
Right.
But this commitment to this jokey sensibility, this commitment not making it real,
that's
which
not commitment.
I'm seeing on all these shows.
Yeah, that's a lack of commitment, by the
that's
way.
That's a lack of commitment.
Right, so you say commitment to make it jokey is actually a lack of commitment to not make it as real as you can.
But the good news is, of course, that it isn't a coincidence that I'm finding all this... I mean, these shows that I've mentioned, the acting on this is... among the worst acting I've ever seen on television, even though television as a whole might be getting better. But watch dramas in the 70s, watch comedies in the 70s, sitcoms, any of them, which might not even hold up well. They might be silly shows, but boy, the actors were
committing. Investing.
They were committing to it. They had a real integrity to it. But what's great about it is that, as we've talked so much before, art, the creative impulse, the artistic impulse needs something to push against.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you can have the work of Bryan Cranston without the work of some of these actors who aren't committing. Because maybe it requires that breath, that difference, for us to truly appreciate how wonderful what he's doing is.
Well, that's an excellent point.
Yeah.
And that's also a thing about, you know, I know actors who come from the deep, steeped theatrical training, both UK, New York, Canada, and they come to Los Angeles, so they can't believe some of the actors that have been raised on just television and films and stuff like that, that their working style and everything seems to them to be this lack of commitment. And now what you're saying is that these actors, that lack of commitment seems to have infected everything.
And well, and they're playing leads. I mean, I've been rewatching. I just got the full Larry Sanders Show on DVD. Yeah. You know, and this is a show, for people who haven't watched it, there is no The Office in the UK and therefore The Office in America if there was not Larry Sanders Show. Ricky Gervais says that. He based right. everything on The Office because, as you described it, when I was talking about Larry Sanders' show once before, you're saying, look, don't even think of it as a show business comedy. It's a workplace comedy.
Totally.
And I was watching behind-the-scenes interviews, and one of the young actors who was a regular on the show was Jeremy Piven. One of his first big things. And he was talking about, you know, you watch his performance in it, his whole performance, his whole commitment was to not laughing during takes.
Right.
My commitment has to be, I'm going to ruin these takes, these brilliant takes of everybody else if I laugh. So he was putting all his focus and commitment into simply not busting up.
Right.
But of course, that does teach him full commitment. And the other thing that he... Which he brings to everything.
Right.
Now, on stage and screen. And he... But the other thing that he said was, and of course, you'll hear this in many different ways and different words from different people, but he said, you know, referring to the work of especially Jeffrey Tambor and Rip Torn, you know, he was reminded watching them that good teachers will tell you that the key to making something funny is to play it even more straight.
More straight.
That's than you the play thing. The drama.
Reese Witherspoon, that's what she said. Her turning point was in Freeway. When she was 18 years old, and she was playing it so committed and so real, and then it came out and everybody goes, oh my God, that's so funny. And she had a career in comedy after that because she was so committed to playing it as real as she could.
Is this what you mean when you have said to a degree that, like, one of the things that improv has taught you is, you know, not blocking, not wimping, not saying no, to really embrace it?
Yes.
That kind of committing to it, because you're never... the thing that makes your improv shows so funny to me, even though I've seen, you know, because I've seen it so many times, yeah, right?
You have.
And but where it will still be funny and still be new is, of course, it is new each time because people are bringing different things to it.
Yep.
But you always are responding and reacting to it as if you want it to be real.
Yeah.
Like, you're a dramatic actor.
Totally.
In it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, and when a sound effect comes on, like it just did, that seems totally out of place, you will respond to that
with an apology.
And with the gravitas of a dramatic actor.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it so funny.
And that's what comedy is. I mean, that's the thing. That made Leslie Nielsen, dearly departed, may rest in peace. He did an Airplane, as he was just as committed in that as he was in Poseidon Adventure and Forbidden Planet. The acting was not any different. All it was the context was different. And so that's your lesson in comedy.
Now, I want to know, you know, and this is not something where there's, you know, going to be obviously an answer to it, but I want to know how much of the legacy of this jokey sensibility, you know, part of it comes from, I'm sure, you know, the hip irony,
yes,
that kids got so into that
in the 90s,
that really wasn't, you know, literary irony, right. And I feel like that you know, that was kind of the bastard offspring of sort of what David Letterman was doing on Late Night with David Letterman.
Right.
But, of course, the problem is never with the person who does it. It's with all the imitators.
Yeah.
Like, we can imitate that tone. But if you just take that tone fresh from the context of him playing some of the most old traditional gags in television,
yep,
that by turning the context with that tone, he was really commenting on something in a very brilliant way. I mean,
yeah,
he was making it his video funhouse.
Yeah, and breaking ground on that.
But then people could... But the tone was easy to copy.
Yeah.
And because, like you said, it's a lack of commitment. And lack of commitment is easy to copy.
Right. Which then gets us to the man-child comedy thing that you hate so much.
Well,
which is the same thing. You're not committing to...
But surprisingly, I want to go back to David Duchovny and I want to go to the X-Files.
I'm surprised.
Because one of the things that was so refreshing about the show is that there would be episodes, whole episodes, that are really funny.
Yeah.
And then there would be lots of moments that were really funny. And there would be some times where you would have almost a comedic episode and you would, if you just heard the story, just the premise of it, you'd go, well, that's not any different than any other X-Files episode.
Right.
Like the tone could be so different from episode to episode, but the tone wasn't dependent upon the plot. The tone really was like, what is the approach that we're taking to this material this week?
Right.
You know, Jose Chung is a great example of kind of talking about the series as a whole, because we will maybe play the same kind of story again and again and again, but we'll come at it tonally from a lot of different angles. And I feel like there were some people like who they're, you know, they'll champion the show because of the jokey episodes.
Right. And others who liked
The conspiracy stuff,
the drama,
whatever,
or the UFO or the monster of the week stuff.
And I will see some of these shows that try to in some way recapture X-Files, be it a Bones, be it a Fringe, be it, you know, what there have been so many I can't even keep track.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I see with them is that they kind of want to have all the good stuff at one time.
Yeah. Jam it all in one episode. Like, yeah. Pack it as much as they can. And then...
And almost like every moment.
Yeah. Well, that's true, too.
Oh, this is a scary monster that's part of our conspiracy. Let's react to it in a jokey manner.
And that comes from, I would think, studio executives. As you always point out with Pirates of the Caribbean 2, where the executives at first didn't want Johnny Depp doing that character.
Yeah.
And then the second one, you see all the execs standing just behind the camera going, do more of that crazy gay character thing, whatever the hell you're doing, right?
Yeah.
So I think that that's what, you know, they dissect it from a hit show in the 90s. Now let's just triple that and jam it into every scene as possible.
It's so interesting that the legacy of something that works will so often be a whole lot of offspring or copies or whatever that don't work at all.
Yeah.
And that might even ruin a genre. I mean, 2001 A Space Odyssey, no studio executive thought this could possibly work.
Yeah.
Even critics at first were not fond of this movie, but audiences loved it.
Yeah,
it made this outrageous amount of money for a science fiction film. There'd never been a hit like this in that genre.
Right.
And adults were going to it. And so what did Hollywood do? Well, for the next 10 years, they tried to recreate. Well, we'll copy it.
Yeah, we'll copy it. Silent Running.
But there were just so many, and they were all huge disasters.
Yes.
And it wasn't until Star Wars, which is not really true science fiction so much as fantasy, you know, based on ancient myths and
stuck in a futuristic world.
But it wasn't until Star Wars that, you know, the success of 2001 A Space Odyssey 9 years earlier was almost vindicated.
Right.
Like, yeah, there is an audience for kind of thoughtful futuristic stories.
But the key to all of this, as you know, is story.
Is story.
Right? I mean, 2001 had a story. Star Wars had a story behind it. And the special effects, and you can all be blinded by that. And then when Battlestar Galactica, the movie, which was really the pilot for the TV series, that didn't really have a story till, you know, 6-10 episodes in. And then, even then, it was just an epic overview without any story going through it, till they rewrote it recently on Sci-Fi and then put a story in it.
And as we've said before, what do we know? I mean, and you and I are men in our 40s now, and I think we're only at the point where we're starting to get a firm grasp on this, which is that the most important thing maybe in story is tone, because if you find the right tone, that's what will allow something to resonate across the ages.
Right.
Rather than how does it play right now, how is it likely to play? Because the tone is what will appeal to people
over
time.
Yeah.
And it's also the most fragile thing, and it's the thing that's the hardest to market.
True. You can't. It's tough to market tone. You can't put that in a 30-second trailer.
Wow. Yeah. So now another thing we wanted to revisit this story about Ronnie Chasen's murder.
Oh, yes.
So last week, it seemed very clear that this is the publicist who was shot 5 times in the chest.
Yes.
In Beverly Hills, going past the Beverly Hills Hotel, and then crashed into a tree or a pole.
Yep.
And that's how people were alerted to this, and the police responded. And they say now that it wasn't a professional hit. It was a robbery gone wrong. This man that the police tracked down who shot himself.
In his hotel lobby.
Apartment lobby. Apartment. It turns out it's, 7 miles away from the event. They claim that he was
hopped
there.
On his bicycle?
On bicycle.
Yeah.
So an African-American man. They laid out all this case of all these things that had gone wrong. He was desperate. And of course, desperate people in desperate times take desperate measures. And his desperate measure was apparently that night to get on a bicycle, drive 7 miles to Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
And
hide the bike.
Hide the bike and then fire into a car speeding along.
Oh, I thought it was at a light. No? Maybe?
Well,
I don't know, right?
5 times patterned in the person's chest.
Through the passenger side window.
And then when the car crashed.
Yeah.
This person had the presence of mind to pick up all the shell casings and dispose of them. Didn't think to reach into the car to steal anything.
Right. Too busy picking up shell cases.
And then rode the bike back the 7 miles or whatever to.
Right. And then bragged he's going to get $10,000 to his neighbors. And then when the police come, that's when
he made the tip or whatever.
Yeah.
Does this not raise more questions?
Well, here's what I think. Probably the police are going, yeah, you know what? We're just closing this case down so that the lead doesn't freak out. Like, clearly, if this guy is hired by a larger thing, that you're not going to go, oh, we're going to go after that thing, and then they run away. You go, look, we're not going to do this. And then that relaxes the paranoia or the pressure of whoever hired this guy so that they can then track him down.
Which is the dumbest thing imaginable, because, of course, the thing that you have going for you when you investigate anything, whether you're an employee trying to investigate who's embezzling, or an employer trying to investigate, or if you're a police officer, whenever you're trying to investigate any kind of wrongdoing or anything, you want to increase the pressure, because, of course, that's when people will start making mistakes.
Right.
And that's how people get caught. Yeah, I mean, it was just amazing the law enforcement reaction to this Beverly Hills Police Department, because it was the Beverly Hills PD. It's not LAPD. It's not County Sheriff.
And they don't have a lot of experience in murders.
Yeah, they did a big press conference about this. And the first thing they say is that as they reveal all this information is that the investigation's only 60% done. And all these other law enforcement people were going, you're having a press conference when only 60% of the case is done? Well, guess what?
Yeah.
If this guy had ever gone to trial, or if anyone else goes to trial for this, your press conference is going to be the defense's opening statement.
Yes. That's true, right?
Yeah.
I mean, wow.
It's just amazing, though, because, L.A., because of these high-profile cases and these celebrity cases, and I've talked about this before, we have this image of, this lawless land.
Yeah.
Criminals get away with everything, and the truth is, in terms of big cities and with violent crime and all this, Los Angeles has a remarkable track record of arrest and conviction comparative to other cities.
It's true.
But in high-profile cases, we're the worst.
Everybody freaks out.
Everything is done politically.
Yes.
Or getting back to it, didn't the Beverly Hills Police Department press conference just seem like a marketing ploy or something?
It did. It actually seemed like Beverly Hills Cops 3. It was very funny.
We're launching a TV series about this.
Ladies and gentlemen, exactly. Here's our brand.
What better way to merchandise it?
Yeah. Come get the t-shirt. I don't know. I still think there's something, I still think there's an ongoing investigation that they're not talking about. And I still think that there's going to be more news about this in the future.
Yeah.
That's my feeling. But
how about this? Of course there should be more news in the future. But how about not a press conference? How about not?
Yeah.
But again, it's Beverly Hills. It's a PR town.
No, no, no. It's not just Beverly. Remember that bank robbery in North Hollywood where they had the armor-piercing shells? Then 10 years later, they still have the police car with the bullet holes that bring that out. And it's like...
What? But it is. It's any high-profile thing, it gets handled so much differently.
So much differently. Ridiculously differently. It's very bizarre.
It becomes almost just a different job altogether.
Yeah. Anyway.
So much to talk about here in this last half of,
let's do this.
Of this show. Another news thing. I mentioned Blue Valentine last week.
Yes,
I
you
had
did.
Seen Blue Valentine with Ryan Gosling and Michelle Williams. And I didn't talk about whether I liked it or not.
Oh.
The acting in it is extraordinary.
I hear.
It is a worthy successor to the tradition of John Cassavetes.
Yeah.
It's not a movie I would watch again, and it didn't always hold my interest.
Yep.
And... the reason being that it was always honest.
Uh-huh.
It just, you know, once you know how they're playing their unique time narrative, how they're playing with time in the narrative, at a certain point you're going, okay, well, since I know what's going to happen and I know how they're playing with time, now I'm just, you know, you can draw a chart of, okay, I can just keep track of the points they hit. And the actors are doing everything they can to make those points honest and authentic. There's not really a lot of, unlike Cassavetes at his best, or at his worst even. Because as I've always said, brilliant filmmakers at their worst are more interesting than most directors at their best.
Yes.
Because even at their worst, there's that moment that they're still capable of where you go, oh my God, I've never seen that before.
Right.
That is so true. That rings so true,
yeah.
That moment. And there aren't that in this film.
Oh.
Anyway.
Ding.
But really great work, and you can understand why Ryan Gosling is going to be working with this director again the summer, and the approach is very well taken. But the NC-17 rating that I railed against last week, Harvey
shifted.
Weinstein himself,
of all people,
argued in because the Weinstein company is releasing
deal.
It.
Yeah,
but he himself went to the MPAA, and you're never really allowed to know who these people on this board are.
I know.
He went and argued the case. They had constitutional lawyers lined up, like David Boies.
I didn't realize
to handle this. Harvey Weinstein argued it himself, and the MPAA rating got changed from NC-17 to R.
Wow.
And so good work, Harvey. Although, let's face it, I think my little tirade last week.
That's really what they listened to. That changed it more.
Had
than
a little her. Something.
I
got to
say, it probably did.
My pointing out the duplicity of, you know, if the woman had been tortured rather than pleasured, it would have been an R rating.
Right.
Not in my house.
Not in my house. And that means now they can advertise on television. I didn't realize
newspapers.
NC-17 has a series of restrictions regarding how you can market it.
Yeah.
And that an R
rating. And then, because of how you can market it, you can't advertise in newspapers. Then there are theaters that can't book it because they can't book it if you're not taking out a certain number of advertisements and a certain number of publications.
Right. I know. It becomes this whole domino effect of your movie losing box office. So the
and it becomes another thing about like what we were talking about off air, you know, about it doesn't really matter because but this idea that so many people will throw around the words freedom of speech and freedom of expression, and it isn't that, because when we talk about freedom of speech or freedom of expression, we're talking about government,
oppression.
Suppression of, and of course it was supposed to be political speech and political content, but really we're talking about, when we're talking about censorship now, we're talking about it from the standpoint of corporate rules.
Yeah. That's right.
That's the threat on expression is corporate. So it's not about freedom, because we never had the right to freedom of speech or freedom of creative expression from corporate rules.
Right.
Because indeed the founders never envisioned the modern corporation. Corporations
didn't come into play until after. Yes.
So now, it really is interesting. But good news. I mean,
great for them.
It does make a big difference.
Yes.
because it is a movie where, you know, again, although I had, you know, certain problems with it, I would like that movie. I would like the investors in that movie because it is an independent film. Absolutely. I would like them to have a chance to see their money back.
Absolutely. See the reward for actually taking a risk.
And the more that happens, then the more people are going to be able to do interesting work and different work.
Absolutely. Still not my Oscar pool, but whatever.
Now, although Ryan Gosling's going to get a Best Actor nomination, of course.
Nomination.
Yeah. And you have to see all the nominees.
Of course.
Horrible box office weekend. It's supposed to be traditionally one of the biggest box office weekends.
Oh, my God.
And it was a horrible box office.
And weekend. I went to The Tourist.
If there is a movie that
I gotta see your neighbor
is the biggest flop of all time, you're gonna see it. And if true. It is combined with, I mean, I wanted to see it because here's Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck, the director of Lives of Others, one of our favorite films. This is his second film.
Yeah.
It's a remake of the European film
Anthony Zimmer
from 5 years ago.
Yeah.
It stars the two biggest box office draws in the world in terms of male and female, Johnny Depp and Angelina Jolie. How about written by two former Oscar-winning screenwriters?
You Gottfried Park, Mr.
Fellow. Christopher McQuarrie, who wrote Usual Suspects.
I know. Stick his name on this.
I mean, that makes sense. And so I thought we were going to go see it, and then, you know, there were no reviews available until about 2 days before, which is always a bad sign. Like, why haven't critics seen this yet?
Very
and then
bad.
The word comes out, you know, one of the in the conversation as one of the worst films of all time.
Right.
And Johnny Depp's performance certainly in the conversation of one of the worst of all time. In fact, the performance that it's being most often compared to is Dan Quayle in the vice presidential debate.
No way. Yeah. Really? I hadn't heard that.
So this thing flops. Okay. Yeah. How does that go wrong?
Well, here's the first thing. I subscribe to Entertainment Weekly specifically because I think all of their press releases are now coded so that you can read between the lines and see if a movie's going to be good or bad other than what they're writing. It's very fascinating. And in that, they said that this movie was prepped in 7 weeks. And basically, they did it as a free vacation to Venice. And that comes through this movie like you wouldn't believe.
Although that's a little bit of revisionist history because Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck was the original director, then left. Another director came on, and then Florian came back to it.
Yeah.
They started making it a couple years ago with Sam Worthington as the lead.
But then everything fell apart.
Everything falls apart. And so to say they prepped it in 7 weeks, well, or they prepped it in 2 years and 7 weeks. I mean,
I don't know. I suppose everybody walked away from a different project.
Feel like that whole story about, 7 weeks and we all did it as a, you know, because it's going to be a good time and everything. You'll hear films marketed that way.
Yeah,
like,
right.
We had such a good time making it.
Yeah, you know.
I worked with our old friend Robert Ballow at Goal and Shadowland. Nothing ever annoyed him more than actors or directors or whatever saying, we had such a good time making it. You know, he would just like mutter under his breath, who cares if you had a good time making it? You know what we want? We want to have a good time watching it.
Yeah, right.
And you having a good time making it is in no way indicative.
Yeah.
In fact, as we were saying earlier, sometimes it had to be that you weren't having a very good time because, you know, it was hard.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
It was hard. I struggled with this project every single day.
I don't think Fred Astaire ever had a good time making it when he was in pain in his shoes, dancing, and Ginger Rogers bleeding
right,
in her
heels.
The
grace and the ease.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things in our documentary, The Truth Is Out There, you know, the tone of it is so rewarding. I think audiences are really going to love this tone. And largely, you know, one of the two major things that creates that tone is you and your persona. But, you know, you can even see in the documentary that the process of making this documentary is taking its toll on you. It's not like this upbeat, lighthearted, hey, let's go have an adventure and let's do this is the easiest thing to come by. Sometimes right. It's the hardest thing to come by.
Yeah, that's
it's
true.
It's just that you were committed to it. And if you're committed to doing it, then it's your responsibility to find that energy within yourself that allows you to say, hey, this is an adventure. Because it's easy to say, dear God, what city am I in? How many months have we been doing this? Am I ever going to see my home again, right?
So anyway, the tourist is very, I don't know. We've spent too much time talking about the tourist. We've got so much to discuss.
Box office. The other thing, though, was that even the number one film, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, they were estimating $40 million for the weekend, and it did $24 million. So even the number one film was a huge disaster,
right?
Especially given what they needed to relaunch this, because the franchise went from Disney then to, I guess, Fox.
This is the
Narnia Chronicles,
yeah,
but
right.
It's a new company. Walt Media partnered with a new company because Disney dropped it.
Right.
Because they dropped the ball on the last one by no longer trying to appeal to the Christian base that is the large audience for it. So it's amazing. So then what's cool about it, though, is that then the headlines, like, because everybody needs to look for good news in the box office, how about the fact that Black Swan cracks the top 10 on 60 screens?
Wow.
As opposed to like 7,000 for the tourist.
Yeah.
60 screens, and it's in the top 10.
And
I mean, it's already
office.
Made like $6 million, and it hasn't played on more than 60 screens.
Wow.
It doesn't hurt that, you know, it sets an all-time record with the Broadcast Film Critics Association for nominations.
Wow.
My former director of photography, with whom I worked on two films and six commercials, Matt Libatique, won the LA Film Critics Award for Best Cinematography for Black Swan.
Look at that.
Yeah.
I'm dying to see it. Of course, my days in ballet, I will totally relate to this.
It's a wonderful, wonderful film. A film that I saw last night that was runner-up for cinematography, LA Film Critics, and that comes out this week and might be their most accessible film.
Ooh.
I saw the Coen Brothers remake of True Grit.
Oh, yeah. What do you think?
And I bring this up. It's lesser Coen Brothers.
Oh.
It's not No Country for Old Men Coen Brothers.
It.
It's not. But I don't mean this pejoratively in the sense that I mean it's lesser in that it's not Serious Man, it's not No Country for Old Men, it's not one of the ones where they're plumbing their own personal psyche.
Serious
and really,
Man, yeah.
I mean, this is, hey, let's make a Western. You know, because sometimes I feel like they go back and forth, like, okay, we're going to do something that maybe is the type of movie we'd want to see.
Right.
Like,
oh,
that
brother,
kind
where
of fun
art thou, or...
versus, you know, and... As far as lesser, that's what I mean by lesser. Not the one where they're going for, you know, the real artistic aim. But
it's more like Hudsucker Proxy.
But as far as the lesser Coen Brothers films go, this is as good as it gets. I mean, this is really, they hit the mark. And I'm reminded of the fact that when we were driving out to Malibu, this was about a year and a half ago, a year and a couple months ago now, after returning from Dragon Con.
Okay.
And we did a show while we drove, and we were talking about this spate of remakes.
Oh, yeah.
And True Grit was one of the ones we talked about.
I remember.
And, you know, you and I, we tend to have this feeling like, you know, remakes are fine. You know, some people get upset, but, you know, the original still exists.
Yes. You'll never lose that.
And you're not going to lose it, and so, who cares? And... The one thing that does get a little frustrating at times when you see all these remakes, you go, well, but if this is where all the money and everything's going, where's the opportunity to do something original?
Right.
Right?
Blue Velvet, or no, Blue Valentine.
And so it is interesting that in the case of, you know, on the same weekend, I see True Grit, you see The Tourist. And, you know, so we get kind of the yin-yang of this.
American film culture.
But also the remake. Culture,
oh, yeah, right.
You know, you get the good and the bad of it, and but the one thing the Coen Brothers did that was really good was, I mean, they went back to the original source material and they did their take on the book.
Yeah, which is pretty smart.
It's hard to lose sight of John Wayne in that role, but it's, you know, it's really wonderfully rewarding. And the truth is that the whole film is based upon, you know, the success of it is based upon the work of a 14-year-old girl,
right?
Both in the original and in this, and she is just. Stunning.
I mean, hear she's
just
good in this.
Something.
Yeah.
Just something.
Carrying a film. That's quite a heavy load.
Yeah, and it's making a lot of top 10 lists. You know, AFI released their list of the 10 best films of the year, and True Grit made it. And you know, it's interesting because I was thinking about, you know, we have so many of these awards shows. We've had the LA Film Critics, you've had the Broadcast Film Critics, AFI released their
People's Choice Awards coming up in the first of the new year.
Indie Spirit nominations came out a couple weeks ago. And, you know, these are independent films that are getting nominated.
Big.
And so the Best Picture nominees were Winter's Bone, which like swept the Gotham Awards for independent films and is making all these lists. But also 127 Hours, Black Swan, The Kids Are All Right. And I was thinking all of these could get Best Picture nominations. They're all in the running. And remember when they expanded to 10?
Yes, exactly.
The Oscar nominations largely to give the studios a better chance of getting films in
there. Right, because all the indies were winning the Oscars.
And what this year is going to do is it's just going to give more spots to indies.
Right.
I mean, I have stopped even hearing Inception named as a shoe-in for Best Picture. I thought that it had to be a Best Picture nomination. But if it weren't for that, and do we consider The Social Network a studio film?
Yeah, I would.
Okay, so you've got Social Network, you've got that. Are there any other non-animated
studio
films that really stand a chance for one of those eight remaining nominations?
I can't think
of one.
And
I'm hard-pressed to think of them.
Yeah.
So it's really, really staggering.
Wow. And now that MGM has gone into chapter
I guess True Grit would be a studio film. But let's face it, when we're talking about the Coen brothers, what do you mean by independent?
Yeah.
They are, in any way that matters, independent.
Right. You can't imagine executives coming and telling the Coen brothers, hey, could you make this, you know, what?
And we've said this before. What does it mean to be independent? And for a show like the Independent Spirit Awards, it has to do with the financing, of course. In the way that it matters is, are the financial interests, do they have undue influence in the creative process?
Right.
And we've seen that on low-budget films
that
are made, quote-unquote, independently, where the group of dentists from Milwaukee that are financing it
are sitting beside the camera.
And, oh, by the way,
my daughter likes to act.
Daughter likes to act. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
In the lead role that's in every scene, from her point of view. Right? That's non-independent.
Yeah, no.
Right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You've given up all your independence.
Ouch.
It's like, we've already established what you are, now we're haggling over price. That's the old joke.
Funniest joke.
But really, just interesting how so many of these. And I wonder at some point if that's why then you hear, like if the Academy had seen the writing on the wall, and that's why...
They opened that up?
Well, or why they have James Franco and Anne Hathaway... as the co-hosts for the Oscars, first to appeal to younger people, but younger people who may not be going to independent films.
Right. Doing the studio.
Who are only going to go to the ones with the big marketing. So that's why they felt the need to get these young stars. Although the irony being that both Anne Hathaway and now James Franco, who might get nominated for 127 Hours, which is an indie film.
Right.
You know, get their Academy cachet from independent films, because wasn't Anne Hathaway, Rachel, getting married?
Yeah.
Right?
So, yeah. Go figure. Well, I think that distinction is so dissolving now anyway that it's almost become pointless.
Well, yeah.
It's like cable and network. You know, it's the same thing.
Well,
like,
I think it will always be an important distinction, but it's an important distinction if we keep, we keep looking at it. Like with the Foreign Language Film Oscar, mm-hmm. That almost has become irrelevant because of their arcane rules.
Yeah.
You know,
financing has
how about
to be
just the five best foreign language films?
Yeah.
Regardless of all your rules for it, like financing had to come from the country of origin, or the, you know, 70% of the crew had to be from that country. How about just if it's a foreign language film, then it's eligible.
Right.
Imagine that. But with independent, I think you need to keep looking at what the discussion, what do we mean by it?
Yeah.
And how are we going to celebrate it? And no matter who you are, if you want creative independence, you are sacrificing something probably to get the film made.
Yeah, it's a series of compromises. It's such a huge endeavor.
And so are we going to reward those artists who are making maybe certain personal sacrifices or whatever in order to be able to maintain the creative integrity of their project and say that that's what we're celebrating when we're celebrating independent.
Right.
And then maybe we can say it doesn't matter so much where it comes from and what company is behind it or anything, because, again, we're celebrating the nature of of independently telling stories with
right.
integrity.
Right.
And an example of where, you know, even the Independent Spirit Awards, where you go, well, okay, I get it. Winner's Bone is independent. I get it. You know, Kids Are All Right, I guess. I get, you know, 127 hours. But then you see Greenberg is nominated for Best Picture. And, you know, Ben Stiller. And this is Noah Baumbach, who has been an independent filmmaker. But, you know, when Ben Stiller is in it, and how about Ben Stiller and James Franco in the next one by Noah Baumbach, along with Greta Gerwig, who's very good in Greenberg, but also Cate Blanchett. You know, it's like, this is this really an independent film?
Right.
Or is this what big-time A-list stars think doing an independent is like?
Yeah. Interesting.
I don't know. So what else do we got? Anything else that we need to chat about?
I was pleased to see inside my Cheerios box. I got a lovely winter's tale of Chaucer's first winter. Look inside your Cheerios box.
So that's what you're reading.
That's what I'm reading. Chaucer's first winter.
I'm reading Tim Gunn's a book.
Oh.
Of his personal lessons, his golden rules for success in life.
Of how to mentor.
And I'm reading Jonathan Franzen's new book, first book since The Corrections, which I think was the best book of the last 50 years. His book, Freedom. I'm reading that.
I'm reading Angel's Flight, the murder mystery detective novel by his name. If I run to my bedside, I will have his name. Angel's Flight. Yeah, that doesn't sound right. But a great detective novel, and I'm in the middle of it. It's awesome.
So, quick hits, I guess. You know, I saw Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest.
Oh, yeah.
The third film, based on that, and now I'm ready to finally read the novels.
Ah, excellent. Enjoy that.
No, we didn't get to the Canada question.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, this is just so awful. I did an Adrian Brody double feature.
Oh.
I saw his Predators.
Oh, yes.
He starred in Predators. Did you see that?
No, I didn't.
This is from Robert Rodriguez's Troublemaker Studios.
Yeah.
And, you know, the first half of it, I like was going, oh, this is kind of reminiscent of good early John Carpenter, like The Thing and that sort of thing. And because they really, I mean, great shots.
And freaking out.
And they let the shots linger enough to allow the suspense to build instead of just trying to create
editing.
The visceral movement and everything. And then it, you know, second half, it kind of falls up. But from a storytelling standpoint, structurally, narratively, it all sort of ends up as less than the sum of its parts.
Damn it.
The other thing I saw was this science fiction film that got mishandled, I think, by being released wide at the beginning of summer.
Yes, Splice.
Splice, from director Vincenzo Natali.
Yeah.
It starred Adrian Brody and Sarah Pauly.
And who doesn't do a lot of studio pictures, you know.
And Vincenzo Natali, well, it's an independent film.
Right.
It was a Sundance premiere, actually. Yeah. And Vincenzo Natali did the sci-fi film Cube.
Yeah,
that was
right.
Very interesting. And another film that our friend Louis Savvy at Sci-Fi London swears by called Nothing, that I can't wait to see.
Yeah, I can't wait to see this thing.
This film, Splice, was so reminiscent of David Cronenberg, and I don't mean that in a good way.
Oh.
And I'm not dissing David Cronenberg, but there is an element of David Cronenberg where you're watching his film, and we kind of went back and forth with this. Like, I want to describe it as being like watching porn.
Yeah.
But it's more like when you're watching David Cronenberg, sometimes it's like you're watching a behind-the-scenes documentary about the making of porn.
Yeah, we talked about this.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
But there's this quality of Splice that is that way.
Hmm.
And it's a film that I thought was kind of undone by the big-name casting because it sort of added undue weight to these scenes and these performances.
Oh.
You know, I'm going into act. Whereas if you'd had actors that were lesser known or unknown or whatever, you might have just bought the concept more at the beginning and then been drawn in more. Because by the end, here's a film where in the second half, you go, oh, it's up to some really interesting things.
Ah.
But I wasn't invested in that first half.
And was
unlike a Predators.
Right. Because the star power was taking you out? Or what? Not investing.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I'm seeing Adrian Brody pretend, but I don't get any, I'm seeing Adrian Brody.
Right.
And he's acting, and Sarah Pauly's acting, but I'm not watching geneticists.
Yeah, I get it. That's too bad.
Now, the thing, and this is a great segue, although I don't know when we're going to get around to discussing this, but it comes from a question that we received from Ulrika.
Right.
And it's something for us to both think about and okay. we'll discuss early next year.
Can't wait.
But I'm watching Splice, and before I knew who the director was, I just knew it was Adrien Brody, independent science fiction film. I didn't know anything else about it. Sarah Pauly, I love all of that. Let me watch it. And then I go, well, this seems a little familiar to certain things. Okay, this had to be shot in Canada. But I don't know why I knew that it was shot in Canada.
Yeah,
it's not
that.
Like there was recognizable landscape.
No.
It's not like it was snow everywhere.
It's just a feel.
There's a feel to it. And
absolutely.
You can tell that it's Canada. Much like Cronenberg.
Yep.
Stuff. And there is a texture to Canadian film.
Yeah. It's true. It's easy to spot, and I can see it in any TV show, and particularly once you're up there and you come down here, you can so see it.
And so I think that this kind of ties in nicely with Ulrika's question, which was she wanted to know how you and I feel that we either are or aren't children of our time.
Ooh.
And of course, the term children of our time is only part of it, because we're both children of specific place and time.
Yeah.
So I think that also, you know, and thinking of this place, how do I know that there is film of Canada and there's a texture
right.
to it? Much like I can tell whenever a film, no matter what the budget was shot in Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
Like Bulgaria. I know the texture of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
That those technicians and craftspeople are bringing to it.
Right. And almost the lens quality.
So
how do we know that?
So well, I think it's something that we'll think about and
yeah.
we'll address on the second show of January 2011.
Can't wait.
Because next week, we have a special guest.
Yes, we do.
On your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. The week after that, we close out the year with a theme show.
Yes.
Our top 10 television series of the decade.
Of the decade, people. It's been 10 years since the year 2000.
And, or 2001. It's been 11 years since 2000.
So,
but it's been a decade of television.
Yes.
So, as we explain on the show.
Right. Luckily.
So that's...
That ends this then. This is our last show.
Our last new show.
Our last new show. So happy New Year.
Happy New Year to everybody, and also happy holidays. And please, I'm going to throw out a couple different websites to everybody.
Yes.
Whether you listen to this show on Jackalope Radio,
yep.
whether you Farpoint on iTunes, whether you come to chillpackhollywood.com, I always list the usual, the Facebook, the Twitter, the MySpace. Instead, let me just throw two things. Get a pen handy. Write these down.
Oh, okay.
There is a website for our documentary, The Truth Is Out There.
Yes.
And it's, of course, http://. No, it's www.truth-is-. This is
not a dash,
but a dash in between them. truth-is-out-there.com.
Right.
And you can become a liker of the film for up-to-the-minute information on Facebook.
Yes.
At facebook.com/truthmovie.
Truth
and, of course,
movie.
We wanted truthmovie.com as the website, but it was taken.
It was taken, yeah.
So many of these things. But anyway, so please visit those sites.
Please do.
You can see on our website the trailer. See some photos, learn about the film, and of course,
follow us all through the next year as it goes through festivals and
into distribution.
Into distribution and marketing. It'll be fun. Till then, I'm Dean Haglund.
And I'm Phil Larenas.
See you next week. I mean, next year.